first Americans. The great promise of genetic data lies not only in what they can tell us about the deepest origins of Native Americans, but also in what genetic data has to say about more recent times, and how populations got to be the way they are today. A prime example is insight into the origin of speakers of Nandini languages, who live along the Pacific coast of North America, in parts of northern Canada, and as far south as Arizona in the United States. The overwhelming consensus among linguists is that these languages stem from an ancestral language no more than a few thousand years old, and that their dispersal over this vast range in northwestern America must have been derived at least in part by migrations. In an astounding development in 2008, the American linguist Edward Vida documented a deeper connection between Nandini languages and a language family of Central Siberia called Yeniseian, once spoken by many populations, though today only the Ket language of the Yeniseian family is still used on a day-to-day basis. These results suggest that despite the enormous distance, a relatively recent migration from Asia gave rise to Nandini speakers in the Americas. What new information does genetics add? Our 2012 study found that the Nandini-speaking Chippewyan carry a type of ancestry not shared with many other Native Americans, providing evidence for the later Asian migration theory. We estimated that this ancestry constituted only around 10% of Chippewyan ancestry, but it was striking all the same. We wondered whether we could use this distinctive strain of ancestry in the Chippewyans as a tracer dye to document an ancestral link between Nandini speakers, like Chippewyans, and individuals from past archaeological cultures who could be studied with ancient DNA. In 2010, Eska Villerslev and colleagues published genome-wide data from an approximately 4,000-year-old lock of hair, taken from a frozen individual of the Sakak culture, the first human culture of Greenland. Their analysis showed that this man belonged to a population that had a distinct blend of ancestry, compared both to first Americans in the South and the Eskimo Aleuts who followed them in the Arctic. Villerslev's group expanded its claim in 2014 when it reported data from several additional Paleo-Eskimos, as people who preceded Eskimo Aleuts are called by archaeologists. All these individuals were broadly related, and the authors argued that they represented a distinct migration from Asia that was different from all prior and subsequent ones. They argued that the Paleo-Eskimos largely went extinct without leaving descendants after the arrival of Eskimo Aleut speakers around 1,500 years ago. In our 2012 study, we tested the idea that the Paleo-Eskimos exemplified by the Sakak individual were descended from a distinct migration to the Americas. To our surprise, we found no statistical evidence for a distinct migration. Instead, our tests were consistent with the possibility that the Sakak derived their ancestry from the same source that contributed to the Nandini-speaking Chippewyans, just in different proportions. Since we know from genetic data that only around 10% of the ancestry of many Nandini speakers today is from this late Asian migration, it is easy to understand why the clustering analysis used by Villerslev's team missed the connection to Nandini speakers. We propose that the Nandini and Sakak might both derive part of their ancestry from the same ancient migration from Asia to the Americas. In 2017, Pavel Flegontov, Stephen Schiffels, and I confirmed that the Paleo-Eskimo lineage did not die out, and instead lives on in the Nandini. By examining rare mutations that reflect recent sharing between diverse Native American and Siberian populations, we found evidence for recent common ancestors between the ancient Sakak individual and present-day Nandini. In fact, the hypothesis that Paleo-Eskimo lineages went extinct after the arrival of Eskimo Aleut speakers is even more profoundly wrong than I had originally suggested in my 2012 paper. The correct way to view the ancestry of present-day speakers of Eskimo Aleut languages is as a mixture of lineages related to Paleo-Eskimos and First Americans. In other words, far from being extinct, the population that included Paleo-Eskimos lives on in mixed form, not just in Nandini speakers, but also in Eskimo Aleut speakers. Our 2017 work also revealed an entirely new and unifying way to view the deep ancestry of the peoples of the Americas. In this new vision, there were just two ancestral lineages that contributed all Native American ancestry, apart from that in Population Y. The first Americans, and the population that brought new small stone tools and the first archery equipment to the Americas around 5,000 years ago, and founded the Paleo-Eskimos. We could show this because, mathematically, we can fit a model to the data in which all Native Americans, excluding Amazonians with their Population Y ancestry, can be described as mixtures of two ancestral populations related differentially to Asians. Mixtures of these two ancestral populations produced the three source populations that migrated from Asia to America, and that are associated with Eskimo Aleut languages, Nadini, and all other languages. A second genetic revelation about Native American population history is clearest in the Chukchi, a population of far northeastern Siberia that speaks a language unrelated to any spoken in the Americas. My analyses revealed that the Chukchi harbor around 40% first American ancestry, due to backflow from America to Asia. For those who are dubious about the idea that descendants of first Americans could have re-expanded out of America and then made a substantial demographic impact on Asia, who are used to thinking about the migratory path between Asia and America as a one-way street, it might be tempting to argue that the genetic affinity of the Chukchi to Native Americans simply reflects that they are the closest cousins of the first Americans in Asia. This bias also impeded my own thinking for more than a year, as I tried to make sense of the data we had from diverse Native Americans. But the genetic data clarify that the affinity is due to back migration, as the Chukchi are more closely related to some populations of entirely first American ancestry than to others. A finding that can only be explained if a sublineage of first Americans that originated well after the initial diversification of first American lineages in North America migrated back to Asia. The explanation for this observation is that the Eskimo Aleut speakers, who established themselves in North America, mixed heavily with local Native Americans, who contributed about half their ancestry, and then took their successful way of life back through the Arctic with them to Siberia, contributing not only to the Chukchi, but also to local speakers of Eskimo Aleut languages. The identification of a reflux of first American ancestry into Asia, a type of finding that is difficult to prove with archaeology, is the kind of surprise that genetics is in a unique position to deliver. A third example of what genetics can offer is the story of the arrival of agriculture to the U.S. Southwest from northern Mexico. Today, these regions are linked by a widespread language family called Uto-Aztecan, which linguists have traditionally viewed as having spread from north to south, based on the fact that most of the languages in this group and some plant names that are shared across the languages are typical of the northern end of the present-day Uto-Aztecan distribution. However, others have argued that the languages radiated northward from Mexico, following the spread of maize agriculture. It has been suggested, most forcefully by the archaeologist Peter Bellwood, that languages and peoples tend to move with the spread of agriculture. Studying the ancient DNA of people who lived before and after the arrival of maize in the region, along with comparison to the present-day inhabitants, can test this theory at least in part. We are beginning to find some clues in ancient DNA. Studies of ancient maize have now shown that this crop first entered the U.S. Southwest by a highland route, inland, over hills, more than 4,000 years ago, and then was replaced by strains of maize of a lowland coastal origin around 2,000 years ago. This is a remarkable example of how plants, too, have had histories of migration and recurrent mixture, although in the case of domesticated crops, the migrations and mixtures are, if anything, likely to be more dramatic, because humans have subjected crops to artificial selection. It will only be a matter of time before we are able to test whether new peoples moved with the new crops. The dream, of course, is to carry out studies like these more systematically. Modern genetic studies and ancient DNA enable us to discover how Native American cultures are connected by links of migration, and how the spread of languages and technologies corresponded to ancient population movements. Many of these stories have been lost because of the European exploitation that has decimated Native American populations and their culture. Genetics offers the opportunity to rediscover lost stories and has the potential to promote not just understanding, but also healing. 8. The genomic origins of East Asians. The failure of the southern route. East Asia, the vast region encompassing China, Japan, and Southeast Asia, is one of the great theaters of human evolution. It harbors more than one-third of the world's population, and a similar fraction of its language diversity. Pottery was first invented there at least 19,000 years ago. It was a jumping-off point for the peopling of the Americas before 15,000 years ago. East Asia witnessed an independent and early invention of agriculture around 9,000 years ago. East Asia has been home to the human family for at least around 1.7 million years, the date of the oldest known Homo erectus skeleton found in China. The earliest human remains excavated in Indonesia are similarly old. Archaic humans, whose skeletal form is not the same as that of humans whose anatomically modern features begin to appear in the African fossil record after around 300,000 years ago, have lived in East Asia continuously since those times. For example, genetic evidence shows that the Denisovans mixed with the ancestors of present-day Australians and New Guineans shortly after 50,000 years ago. And archaeological and skeletal evidence shows that the 1-meter-tall hobbits also persisted until around this same time on Flores Island in Indonesia. There has been intense debate about the extent to which the archaic humans of East Asia contributed genetically to people living today. Chinese and Western geneticists nearly all agree that present-day humans outside of Africa descend from a dispersal after around 50,000 years ago, which largely displaced previously established human groups. Some Chinese anthropologists and archaeologists, on the other hand, have documented similarities in skeletal features and stone tool styles in people who lived in East Asia before and after this time, raising the question of whether there has been some degree of continuity. At the time of this writing, our knowledge of East Asian population history is relatively limited compared to that of West Eurasia, because less than 5% of published ancient DNA data comes from East Asia. The difference reflects the fact that ancient DNA technology was invented in Europe, and it is nearly impossible for researchers to export samples from China and Japan because of government restrictions or a preference that studies be led by local scientists. This has meant that these regions have missed out on the first few years of the ancient DNA revolution. In the West, the grand narrative is that sometime after around 50,000 years ago, modern humans began making sophisticated upper Paleolithic stone tools, which are characterized by narrow stone blades struck in a new way from pre-prepared cores. The Near East is the earliest known site of upper Paleolithic stone tools, and this technology spread rapidly to Europe and northern Eurasia. It would be natural to expect, given how successful the people who made Upper Paleolithic technology were, that this know-how would have overspread East Asia too. But that is not what happened. The archaeological pattern in the East does not conform to that in the West. Around 40,000 years ago, and across a vast tract of land in China and east of India, there is indeed archaeological evidence of great behavioral change associated with the arrival of modern humans, including the use of sophisticated bone tools, shell beads, or perforated teeth for body decoration, and the world's earliest known cave art. In Australia, archaeological evidence of human campsites makes it clear that modern humans arrived there at least by about 47,000 years ago, which is about as old as the earliest evidence for modern humans in Europe. So it is absolutely clear that modern humans arrived in East Asia and Australia around the same time as they came to Europe. But, puzzlingly, the first modern humans in Central and Southern East Asia, and those in Australia, did not use Upper Paleolithic stone tools. Instead, they used other technologies, some of which were more similar to those used by modern humans in Africa tens of thousands of years earlier. Prompted by these observations, the archaeologists, Marta Mirasson-Lahr and Robert Foley, argued that the first humans in Australia might derive from a migration of modern humans out of Africa and the Near East prior to the development of Upper Paleolithic technology in the West. According to this southern route hypothesis, the migrants left Africa well before 50,000 years ago and skirted along the coast of the Indian Ocean, leaving descendants today among the indigenous people of Australia, New Guinea, the Philippines, Malaysia, and the Andaman Islands. The anthropologist Katerina Harvati and colleagues also documented skeletal similarities between Australian Aborigines and Africans that, they argued, provide evidence for this model. The southern route hypothesis was far more than a claim that there were modern humans outside of Africa well before 50,000 years ago, a fact that every serious scholar now accepts. Evidence of early modern humans outside of Africa well before 50,000 years ago includes the morphologically modern skeletons in Skul and Hafsa in present-day Israel that date to between around 130,000 to 100,000 years ago. Stone tools found at the site of Jebel Fea from around 130,000 years ago are similar to ones found in northeast Africa from around the same time, suggesting that modern humans made an early crossing of the Red Sea into Arabia. There is also tentative genetic evidence of an early impact of modern humans outside Africa, with Neanderthal genomes harboring a couple of percent of ancestry that may derive from interbreeding with a modern human lineage that separated a couple of hundred thousand years ago from present-day human lineages, as expected if a modern human population possibly related to that in Skul and Hafsa interbred with Neanderthal ancestors. Although many geneticists, including me, are still on the fence about whether this finding, or earlier interbreeding between modern humans and Neanderthals, is compelling, the key point is that almost all scholars now agree that there were early dispersals of modern humans into Asia that preceded the widely accepted dispersals after 50,000 years ago that contributed in a major way to all present-day non-Africans. The outstanding question raised by the southern route hypothesis is not whether such expansions occurred, but whether they had an important long-term impact on humans living today. In 2011, Eska Villislev led a study that seemed to show that the early expansions indeed left an impact. He and his colleagues reported a four-population test, showing that Europeans share more mutations with East Asians than with Aboriginal Australians, as would be expected from a southern route contribution to the lineage of Australians. Applying a southern route migration model to the genomic data, they estimated that Australian Aborigines harbor ancestry from a modern human population that split from present-day Europeans at twice the time depth that East Asian ancestors split from Europeans, 75,000 to 62,000 years ago, versus 38,000 to 25,000 years ago. There was a problem, though, which is that the analysis did not account for the 3 to 6% of ancestry that Australians inherited from archaic Denisovans. Because Denisovans were so divergent from modern humans, mixture from them could cause Europeans to share more mutations with Chinese than with Australian Aborigines. Indeed, this explained the findings. My laboratory showed that after accounting for Denisovan mixture, Europeans do not share more mutations with Chinese than with Australians. And so Chinese and Australians derive almost all their ancestry from a homogeneous population, whose ancestors separated earlier from the ancestors of Europeans. This revealed that a series of major population splits in the history of non-Africans occurred in an exceptionally short time span, beginning with the separation of the lineages leading to West Eurasians and East Eurasians, and ending with the split of the ancestors of Australian Aborigines from the ancestors of many mainland East Eurasians. These population splits all occurred after the time when Neanderthals interbred with the ancestors of non-Africans, 54 to 49,000 years ago, and before the time when Denisovans and the ancestors of Australians mixed, genetically estimated to be 12% more recent than the Neanderthal slash modern human admixture, that is, 49 to 44,000 years ago. The rapid succession of lineage separations during the relatively short interval between Neanderthal and Denisovan interbreeding with modern humans suggests that throughout Eurasia, modern humans were moving into new environments, where their technology or lifestyle allowed them to expand, displacing the previously resident groups. The spread was so fast that it is hard to imagine that archaic humans, who had already been resident there for close to 2 million years, and who we know were also there when modern humans expanded, based on the evidence of interbreeding with Denisovans, put up much resistance. Even if early modern humans expanded into East Asia via a southern route, they were likely also replaced by later waves of human migrants, and can be ruled out as having contributed more than a very small percentage of the ancestry of present-day people. In East Asia, as in West Eurasia, the expansion of modern humans out of Africa and the Near East had an effect akin to the erasing of a blackboard, creating a blank slate for the new people. The old populations of Eurasia collapsed, and in their place came new groups that swiftly inhabited the landscape. There is no genetic evidence of any substantial ancestry from these earlier populations in present East Asians. So if essentially all modern human ancestry in East Asia and Australia today derives from the same group that contributed to West Eurasians, what explains how Southeast Asians and Australians missed out on the upper Paleolithic technology that is so tightly linked with the spread of modern human populations into the Near East and Europe? The first long-bladed stone tools characteristic of upper Paleolithic technology in the archaeological record date to between 50,000 and 46,000 years ago. But genetically, the split of the lineages leading to West Eurasians and East Asians may have been more ancient, since, as I have discussed, it almost certainly occurred within a few thousand years after the admixture of modern humans with Neanderthals, 54,000 to 49,000 years ago. So the main split of West Eurasian and East Asian ancestors could have occurred before the development of Upper Paleolithic technology, and the geographic distribution of this technology could just reflect the spread of the population that invented it. There is a piece of corroborating evidence for the theory that Upper Paleolithic technology developed after the split of the main lineages leading to West Eurasians and East Asians. The ancient North Eurasians, known earliest from the approximately 24,000-year-old remains of the boy from the Malta site in eastern Siberia, are on the lineage leading to West Eurasians, which has always been puzzling for geneticists, because the ancient North Eurasians lived geographically closer to East Asia. But it makes sense in light of the geographic distribution of Upper Paleolithic stone tools, which are associated not just with West Eurasians, but also North Eurasians and Northeast Asians. Both the distributions of stone tool technology and of genetic ancestry are as expected, if Upper Paleolithic technology came into full flower in a population that lived prior to the separation of the lineages leading to ancient North Eurasians and West Eurasians, but after the separation of the lineage leading to East Asians. Whatever the reason for the fact that Upper Paleolithic technology never spread to southern East Asia, it is clear from what happened next, and the success these people had in displacing the previously resident populations such as Denisovans, that Upper Paleolithic technology itself was not essential to the successful spread of modern humans into Eurasia after around 50,000 years ago. It was something more profound than Upper Paleolithic stone tool technology, an inventiveness and adaptability of which the technology was just a manifestation, that allowed these expanding modern humans to prevail everywhere, including in the East. The beginnings of modern East Asia. The first genomic survey of modern East Asian populations was published in 2009 and reported data on nearly 2,000 individuals from almost 75 populations. The authors focused on their finding that human diversity is greater in Southeast Asia than in Northeast Asia. They interpreted this pattern as evidence of a single wave of modern humans reaching Southeast Asia, and then spreading from there northward into China and beyond, following a model in which the genetic diversity of present-day populations can be accounted for by a single population moving out of Africa and spreading in all directions, losing genetic diversity as each small pioneer group budded off. But we now know that this model is likely to be of limited use. In Europe, there have been multiple population replacements and deep mixtures. And we now know from ancient DNA that present-day patterns of diversity in West Eurasia provide a distorted picture of the first modern human migrations into the region. The model of a south-to-north migration, losing diversity along the way, is profoundly wrong for East Asia. In 2015, Chuan Chao Wang arrived in my laboratory bearing a treasure. Genome-wide data from about 400 present-day individuals from about 40 diverse Chinese populations. China had been sparsely sampled in DNA studies because of regulations limiting the export of biological material. Wang and his colleagues therefore did the genetic work in China, and he brought the data to us electronically. Over the next year and a half, we analyzed these data, together with more data from other East Asian countries that had previously been published, and with ancient DNA from the Russian Far East generated in our lab. This allowed us to come up with new genetic insights about the deep population history of East Asia and the origins of its current inhabitants. By using a principal component analysis, we found that the ancestry of the great majority of East Asians living today can be described by three clusters. The first cluster is centered on people currently living in the Amur River Basin on the boundary between northeastern China and Russia. It includes ancient DNA data that my laboratory and others had obtained from the Amur River Basin. So this region has been inhabited by genetically similar populations for more than 8,000 years. The second cluster is located on the Tibetan Plateau, a vast area north of the Himalayas, much of which is at a higher altitude than the tallest of the European Alps. The third cluster is centered in Southeast Asia, and is most strongly represented by individuals from indigenous populations living on the islands of Hainan and Taiwan off the coast of mainland China. We used four population test statistics to evaluate models of the possible relationships among present-day populations representing these clusters and Native Americans, Andaman Islanders, and New Guineans. The latter three populations have been largely isolated from the ancestors of mainland East Asians, at least since the last ice age, and their East Asian-related ancestry effectively serves as ancient DNA from that period. Our analysis supported a model of population history, in which the modern human ancestry of the great majority of mainland East Asians living today derives largely from mixtures, in different proportions, of two lineages that separated very anciently. Members of these two lineages spread in all directions, and their mixture with each other, and with some of the populations they encountered, transformed the human landscape of East Asia. The ghost populations of the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers. One of the handful of places in the world where farming independently began was China. Archaeological evidence shows that starting around 9,000 years ago, farmers started tilling the windblown sediments near the Yellow River in northern China, growing millet and other crops. Around the same time, in the south, near the Yangtze River, a different group of farmers began growing other crops, including rice. Yangtze River agriculture expanded along two routes, a land route that reached Vietnam and Thailand beginning around 5,000 years ago, and a maritime route that reached the island of Taiwan around the same time. In India and in Central Asia, Chinese agriculture collided for the first time with the expansion of agriculture from the Near East. Language patterns also hint at the possibility of movements of people. Today, the languages of mainland East Asia comprise at least 11 major families. Sino-Tibetan, Tai-Kadai, Austronesian, Austroasiatic, Hmong-Nien, Japonic, Indo-European, Mongolic, Turkic, Tungusic, and Koreanic. Peter Bellwood has argued that the first six correspond to expansions of East Asian agriculturalists disseminating their languages as they moved. What can we say based on the genetics? Because of restrictions on exporting skeletal material from China, the information that genetic data currently provide about the deep population history of East Asia is far behind that of West Eurasia or even of America. Nevertheless, Wang learned what he could based on the little ancient DNA data we had and patterns of variation in present-day people. We found that in Southeast Asia and Taiwan, there are many populations that derive most or all of their ancestry from a homogeneous ancestral population. Since the locations of these populations strongly overlap with the regions where rice farming expanded from the Yangtze River Valley, it is tempting to hypothesize that they descend from the people who developed rice agriculture. We do not yet have ancient DNA from the first farmers of the Yangtze River Valley, but my guess is that they will match this reconstructed Yangtze River ghost population, the name that we have given the population that contributed the overwhelming majority of ancestry to present-day Southeast Asians. But we found that the Han Chinese, the world's largest group with a census size of more than 1.2 billion, is not consistent with descending directly from the Yangtze River ghost population. Instead, the Han also have a large proportion of ancestry from another deeply divergent East Asian lineage. The highest proportions of this other ancestry are found in Northern Han, consistent with work since 2009 that has shown that the Han harbors subtle differences along a north-to-south gradient. This pattern is as expected from a history in which the ancestors of the Han radiated out from the north and mixed with locals as they spread south. What could the other ancestry type be? The Han, who unified China in 202 BCE, are believed, based on historical sources, to have emerged from the earlier Huaxia tribes, who themselves emanated from earlier groups in the Yellow River Valley of northern China. This was one of the two Chinese regions where farming originated, and it is also the place from which farming spread to the eastern Tibetan Plateau, beginning around 3,600 years ago. Since the Han and Tibetans are also linked by their Sino-Tibetan languages, we wondered whether they might share a distinctive type of ancestry as well. When Wang built his model of deep East Asian population history, he found that the Han and Tibetans both harbored large proportions of their ancestry from a population that no longer exists in unmixed form, and that we could exclude as having contributed ancestry to many Southeast Asian populations. Because of the combined evidence of archaeology, language, and genetics, we called this the Yellow River Ghost Population, hypothesizing that it developed agriculture in the north while spreading Sino-Tibetan languages. Ancient DNA from the first farmers of the Yellow River Valley will reveal whether this conjecture is correct. Once available, ancient DNA will also make it possible to learn about features of East Asian population history that are impossible to discern, based on analysis only of populations living today, whose deep history has been clouded by many additional layers of migration and mixture. The Great Admixtures at the East Asian Periphery. Once the core agricultural populations of the Chinese plain, the Yangtze and Yellow River ghost populations, formed, they expanded in all directions, mixing with groups that had arrived in earlier millennia. The peoples of the Tibetan Plateau, who harbor a mixture of about two-thirds of their ancestry from the same Yellow River ghost population that contributed to the Han, are one example of this expansion. They likely brought farming for the first time to the region, as well as about one-third of their ancestry from an early branch of East Asians that plausibly corresponds to Tibet's indigenous hunter-gatherers. Another example is the Japanese. For many tens of thousands of years, the Japanese archipelago was dominated by hunter-gatherers. But after around 2300 years ago, mainland-derived agriculture began to be practiced and was associated with an archaeological culture with clear similarities to contemporary cultures on the Korean Peninsula. The genetic data confirm that the spread of farming to the islands was mediated by migration. Modeling present-day Japanese as a mixture of two anciently divergent populations of entirely East Asian origin, one related to the Ainu, who today are restricted to the northernmost Japanese island, and whose DNA is similar to that of pre-farming hunter-gatherers. Naruya Saito and colleagues estimated that present-day Japanese have about 80% farmer and 20% hunter-gatherer ancestry. Relying on the sizes of segments of farmer-related ancestry in present-day Japanese, we and Saito estimated the average date of mixture to be around 1600 years ago. This date is far later than the first arrival of farmers to the region, and suggests that, after their arrival, it may have taken hundreds of years for social segregation between hunter-gatherers and farmers to break down. The date corresponds to the Kofun period, the first time when many Japanese islands were united under a single rule, perhaps marking the beginnings of the homogeneity that characterizes much of Japan today. Ancient DNA is also revealing the deep history of humans in mainland Southeast Asia. In 2017, my laboratory extracted DNA from ancient humans at the almost 4,000-year-old site of Mon Bac in Vietnam, where people with skeletons similar in shape to those of Yangtze River agriculturalists and East Asians today were buried side by side with individuals with skeletons more similar to those of the previously resident hunter-gatherers. Mark Lipson in my laboratory showed that in ancient Vietnam, all the samples we analyzed were a mixture of an early splitting lineage of East Eurasians and the Yangtze River ghost population, with the proportion of the Yangtze River ghost population higher in some of the Mon Bac farmers we analyzed than in others. The main group of Mon Bac farmers also had proportions of ancestry from these two lineages that were similar to those seen in present-day speakers of isolated Austroasiatic languages. These findings are consistent with the theory that Austroasiatic languages were spread by a movement of rice farmers from southern China, who interbred with local hunter-gatherers. Even today, large Austroasiatic-speaking populations in Cambodia and Vietnam harbor substantial, albeit smaller, proportions of this hunter-gatherer ancestry. The genetic impact of the population spread that also dispersed Austroasiatic languages went beyond places where these languages are spoken today. In another study, Lipson showed that in Western Indonesia, where Austronesian languages are predominant, a substantial share of the ancestry comes from a population that derives from the same lineages as some Austroasiatic speakers on the mainland. Lipson's discovery suggested that Austroasiatic speakers may have come first to Western Indonesia, followed by Austronesian speakers with very different ancestry. This might explain why linguists Alexander Adelaar and Roger Blench noticed the presence of Austroasiatic loan words, words with an origin in another language group, in the Austronesian languages spoken on the island of Borneo. Alternatively, Lipson's findings could be explained if Austronesian-speaking farmers took a detour through the mainland, mixing with local Austroasiatic-speaking populations there, before spreading farther to Western Indonesia. The most impressive example of the movements of farmers from the East Asian heartland to the periphery is the Austronesian expansion. Today, Austronesian languages are spread across a vast region, including hundreds of remote Pacific islands. Archaeological, linguistic, and genetic data taken together have suggested that around 5,000 years ago, mainland East Asian farming spread to Taiwan, where the deepest branches of the Austronesian language family are found. These farmers spread southward to the Philippines about 4,000 years ago, and farther south around the large island of New Guinea, and into the smaller islands to its east. About the same time they spread from Taiwan, they probably invented outrigger canoes, boats with logs propped on the side that increased their stability in rough waters, making it possible to navigate the open seas. After 3,300 years ago, ancient peoples making pottery, in a style called Lapita, appeared just to the east of New Guinea, and soon afterwards started expanding farther into the Pacific, quickly reaching Vanuatu, 3,000 kilometers from New Guinea. It took only a few hundred more years for them to spread through the western Polynesian islands, including Tonga and Samoa. And then, after a long pause, lasting until around 1,200 years ago, they spread to the last habitable Pacific islands of New Zealand, Hawaii, and Easter Island by 800 years ago. The Austronesian expansion to the west was equally impressive, reaching Madagascar off the coast of Africa, 9,000 kilometers to the west of the Philippines, at least 1,300 years ago, and explaining why almost all Indonesians today, as well as people from Madagascar, speak Austronesian languages. Mark Lipson in my laboratory identified a genetic tracer dye for the Austronesian expansion, a type of ancestry that is nearly always present in peoples who speak Austronesian languages. Lipson found that nearly all people who speak these languages harbor at least part of their ancestry from a population that is more closely related to Aboriginal Taiwanese than it is to any mainland East Asian population. This supports the theory of an expansion from the region of Taiwan. Although there are genetic, linguistic, and archaeological common threads that make a compelling case for the Austronesian expansion, some geneticists balked at the suggestion that the first humans who peopled the remote islands of the Southwest Pacific during the Lapita dispersal were unmixed descendants of farmers from Taiwan. How could these migrants have passed over the region of Papua New Guinea, occupied for more than 40,000 years, while mixing little with its inhabitants? Such a scenario seemed improbable in light of the fact that today all Pacific Islanders east of Papua New Guinea have at least 25% Papuan ancestry, and up to around 90%. How could this fit with the prevailing hypothesis that the Lapita archaeological culture was forged during a period of intense exchange between people ultimately originating in the farming center of China, via Taiwan, and New Guineans? In 2016, ancient DNA struck again, disproving the view that had prevailed until then in the genetic literature. Well-preserved ancient DNA is hard to find in tropical climates like those of the southern Pacific. But the ability to get working DNA from the Pacific changed when, as described earlier, Ron Pinhassi and colleagues showed that DNA from the dense petrous bone of the skull, containing the structures of the inner ear, sometimes preserves up to 100 times more DNA than can typically be obtained from other bones. We initially struggled to study samples from the Pacific, but when we tried petrous bones, our luck changed. We succeeded at getting DNA from ancient people associated with the Lapita pottery culture in the Pacific islands of Vanuatu and Tonga, who lived from around 3,000 to 2,500 years ago. Far from having substantial proportions of Papuan ancestry, we found that, in fact, they had little or none. This showed that there must have been a later major migration from the New Guinea region into the remote Pacific. The late migration must have begun by at least 2,400 years ago. As all the Vanuatu samples we have analyzed from that time and afterward had at least 90% Papuan ancestry. How this later wave could have so comprehensively replaced the descendants of the original people who made Lapita pottery, and yet retained the languages these people probably spoke, remains a mystery. But the genetic data show that this is what happened. This is the kind of result that only genetics can deliver. The definitive documentation that major movements of people occurred. This proof of interaction between highly divergent peoples puts the ball back into the court of archaeologists to explain the nature and effects of those migrations. Ancient DNA from the Southwest Pacific has continued to produce unexpected findings. When we and Johannes Krauss's laboratory, working independently, analyze the Papuan ancestry in Vanuatu, we found that it was more closely related to that in groups currently living in the Bismarck Islands near New Guinea than to groups currently living in the Solomon Islands, despite the fact that the Solomon Islands are directly along the ocean sailing path to Vanuatu. We also found that the Papuan ancestry present in remote Polynesian islands is not consistent with coming from the same source as that in Vanuatu. Thus, there must have been not one, not two, but at least three major migrations into the open Pacific, with the first migration bringing East Asian ancestry and the Lapita pottery culture, and the later migrations bringing at least two different types of Papuan ancestry. So instead of a simple story, the spread of humans into the open Pacific was highly complex. Can we ever hope to reconstruct the details of these migrations? There is every reason to be hopeful. Our picture of how the present-day populations of the Pacific Islands formed is becoming increasingly clear, thanks to access to ancient DNA from the region, and the fact that some islands have less complex population histories than mainland groups because of their isolation, permitting easier reconstruction of what occurred. Through genome-wide studies of modern and ancient populations, we will soon have a far more accurate picture of how humans moved through this vast region. But right now, our understanding of what happened in mainland East Asia remains murky and limited. The extraordinary expansion of the Han over the last 2,000 years has added one more level of massive mixing to the already complex population structure that must have been established after thousands of years of agriculture in the region, and after the rise and fall of various Stone Age, Copper Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age groups. This means that any attempt to reconstruct the deep population history of East Asia, based on patterns of variation in present-day people, must be viewed with great caution. But as I write this chapter, the tsunami of the ancient DNA revolution is cresting, and it will shortly crash on East Asian shores. State-of-the-art ancient DNA laboratories have been founded in China, and are turning their powers to investigating collections of skeletal material that have been assembled over decades. Ancient DNA studies of these and other skeletons will reconstruct how the peoples of each ancient mainland East Asian culture relate to each other and to people living today. Our understanding of the deep interrelationships of the ancestral populations of East Asians and of movements of people since the end of the last ice age will soon be as clear as our understanding of what happened in Europe. But it is hard to predict what ancient DNA studies in East Asia will show. While we are beginning to have a relatively good idea of what happened in Europe, Europe does not provide a good roadmap for what to expect for East Asia, because it was peripheral to some of the great economic and technological advances of the last 10,000 years, whereas China was at the center of changes like the local invention of agriculture. What this means is that while we can be sure that the findings from ancient DNA studies in East Asia will be illuminating, we do not yet know what they will be. All we can be sure of is that ancient DNA studies will change our understanding of the human past in this most populous part of the world. 9. Rejoining Africa to the Human Story. A new perspective on our African homeland. The recognition that Africa is central to the human story has, paradoxically, distracted attention from the last 50,000 years of its prehistory. The intensive study of what happened in Africa before 50,000 years ago is motivated by a universal recognition of the importance of the Middle to later Stone Age transition in Africa, and the Middle to Upper Paleolithic transition at the doorstep of Africa. Those great leaps forward in recognizably modern human behavior, attested to in the archaeological record. However, scholars have shown limited interest in Africa after this period. When I go to talks, a common slip of the tongue is that we left Africa, as if the protagonists of the modern human story must be followed to Eurasia. The mistaken impression is that once Africa gave birth to the ancestral population of non-Africans, the African story ended, and the people who remained on the continent were static relics of the past, jettisoned from the main plot, unchanging over the last 50,000 years. The contrast between the richness of the information we currently have about the human story in Eurasia over the last 50,000 years and the dearth of information about Africa over the same period is extraordinary. In Europe, where most of the research has been done, archaeologists have documented a detailed series of cultural transformations, from Neanderthals to pre-Aurignacian modern humans to Aurignacians to Gravettians to the people who practiced Mesolithic culture, and then to Stone Age farmers and their successors in the Copper, Bronze, and Iron Ages. The ancient DNA revolution, which has disproportionately sampled bones from Eurasia, and especially from Europe, has further widened the gap in our understanding of the prehistory of Africa compared to that of Eurasia. But of course, what all investigations that scratch below the surface show is that the people left behind in Africa changed just as much as the descendants of the people who emigrated. The main reason we don't know as much about the modern human story in Africa is lack of research. Human history over the last tens of thousands of years in Africa is an integral part of the story of our species. Focusing on Africa as the place where our species originated, while it might seem to highlight the importance of Africa, paradoxically does Africa a disservice by drawing attention away from the question of how populations that remained in Africa got to be the way they are today. With ancient and modern DNA, we can rectify this. The deep mixture that formed modern humans. In 2012, Sarah Tishkoff and her colleagues studied the biological impact of archaic admixture on the genomes of present-day Africans without access to ancient genomes like those of Neanderthals and Denisovans that had been used to document interbreeding between archaic and modern humans in Eurasia. Tishkoff and her colleagues sequenced genomes from some of the most diverse populations of Africa and analyzed their data to search for a pattern that is predicted when there has been interbreeding with archaic humans, very long stretches of DNA that have a high density of differences compared to the great majority of other genomes, consistent with an origin in a highly divergent population that was isolated until recently from modern humans. When they applied this approach to present-day non-Africans, they pulled out stretches of DNA that they found were nearly exact matches to the Neanderthal sequence. Tishkoff and her colleagues also found long stretches of deeply divergent sequences in present-day Africans whose ancestors did not mix with Neanderthals. Since the Neanderthals have contributed little, if any, ancestry to Africans, this was likely to have been the result of mixture with mystery African archaic humans, ghost populations whose genomes have not yet been sequenced. Jeffrey Wall and Michael Hammer, using the same types of genetic signatures, attempted to learn something about the relationship of the archaic populations to present-day Africans. They estimated that the archaic population separated from the ancestors of present-day humans in Africa about 700,000 years ago, and remixed around 35,000 years ago, contributing about 2% of the ancestry of some present-day African populations. However, it is important to view these dates and estimated proportions of mixture with caution because of uncertainties about the rate at which mutations occur in humans, and because of the limited amount of data Wall and Hammer analyzed. The possibility of admixture between modern and archaic humans in sub-Saharan Africa is exciting, and there are even human remains from West Africa dating to as late as 11,000 years ago, with archaic features, providing skeletal evidence in support of the idea that archaic and modern human populations coexisted in Africa until relatively recently. Thus, there were ample opportunities for interbreeding with archaic humans as modern humans expanded in Africa, just as in Eurasia. If the proportion of admixture with archaic African humans was only around 2%, as Wall and Hammer estimated, it is likely to have had only a modest biological effect, similar to the effect of the contribution of Neanderthals and Denisovans to the genetic makeup of present-day people outside Africa. However, this does not rule out the possibility of major mixture events in deep African history, the best evidence for deep mixture of modern human populations in sub-Saharan Africa comes from the frequencies of mutations. One generation after a mutation occurs, it is extremely rare, as it is present in only a single person. In subsequent generations, the mutation's frequency fluctuates upward or downward at random, depending on the number of offspring to which it happens to be transmitted. Most mutations never achieve a substantial frequency, as at some point the few individuals carrying them happen not to transmit them to their children, causing them to fluctuate down to 0% frequency and disappear forever. The effect of this constant pumping into the population of rare new mutations is that there are expected to be fewer common than rare mutations in a population. The frequencies of mutations that are variable in a population are in fact expected to follow an inverse law, with twice as many mutations that occur at 10% frequency as those that occur at 20% frequency, and twice as many of these in turn as those that occur at 40% frequency. My colleague Nick Patterson tested this expectation, focusing on mutations present in a large sample of individuals from the Yoruba group of Nigeria that were also present in the Neanderthal genome. Patterson's focus on mutations present in Neanderthals was clever. He knew that mutations discovered in this way were almost certainly frequent in the common ancestral population of humans and Neanderthals, and by implication, in their descendants too. Mathematically, the expectation that such mutations would be common is exactly counterbalanced by the inverse law, with the result that mutations meeting these criteria are expected to be equally distributed across all frequencies. But the real data showed a different pattern. When Patterson examined sequences from present-day Yoruba, he observed a greatly elevated rate of mutations, both at very high and low frequencies, instead of an equal distribution across all frequencies. This U-shaped distribution of mutation frequencies is what would be expected in the case of ancient mixture. After two populations separate, random frequency fluctuation occurs in each population, so that the mutations that fluctuate by chance to 0% or 100% frequency in one population are by and large not expected to be the same as those that do so in the other population. When the populations then remix, the mutations that rose to extreme frequencies in one population, but not in the other, would be reintroduced as variable genetic types. This would produce peaks of extra mutation density in the mixed population. The first peak corresponding to mutations that rose to extreme frequencies in the first population is expected to start at the proportion of mixture, while the second peak corresponding to mutations that rose to extreme frequencies in the second population is expected to start at 100% minus the proportion of mixture. This is exactly the pattern that Patterson found, and he showed that it could be explained if Yoruba descended from a mixture of two highly differentiated human populations in close to equal proportions. Patterson tested whether the patterns he observed were consistent with a model in which only Yoruba descend from this mixture, but non-Africans do not. But this was contradicted by the data. Instead, all non-Africans, and even divergent African lineages such as San hunter-gatherers, also seem to be descended from a similar mixture. Thus, although Patterson had begun by looking at West Africans, the mixture event he detected was not specific to that population. Rather, it seemed to be a shared event in the ancestry of present-day humans, suggesting that the mixture may have occurred close to the time when anatomically modern human features first appear in the skeletal record, after around 300,000 years ago. Patterson's findings resonated with a discovery from the 2011 study by Heng Li and Richard Durbin, discussed in Part 1, that reconstructed human population size history from a single person's genome. That study compared the genome sequence a person gets from his or her mother to the sequence he or she gets from his or her father. It found fewer locations in the genome where the reconstructed age of the shared ancestor falls between 400,000 and 150,000 years ago than would be expected if the population had been constant in size. One possible explanation for this result is that the ancestral population of all modern humans was very large over this period.